religions. And by secular religions, I mean religions that either don't believe that God exists, or they believe God exists and he's irrelevant. Kind of the first major secular religion in America was deism, the idea that God created the world and left it alone. That's kind of the halfway house between Christianity and atheism. You know, what's the difference between an irrelevant God and no God at all? And so we'll talk a little bit about deism, and then we'll get right into atheism, modern atheism, and we'll talk about agnosticism, talk a little bit about evolution. Secular humanism is the blatant attempt to make a religion out of American Western atheism. We'll talk a little bit about that, about the Humanist Manifestos 1 and 2. We'll talk about Marxism, you know, Marxist communism, nihilism, existentialism, and postmodernism. And then we'll try to give a Christian response to atheism. And in order to do that, what we need to do is we need to argue for the possibility of miracles, that miracles are possible. And of course, we as Christians believe that Jesus and the apostles, the prophets performed miracles, and God miraculously inspired human authors to record his word without error. So we have to argue that miracles are possible. Deism and atheism start with the premise that miracles are impossible. This idea that, you know, New Testament scholars have disproven the Jesus of the Bible and the true Jesus of history is not the Jesus of the Bible. He's a non-miraculous Jesus. No, that's assumed at the start. And then based on that assumption, they throw out any passages that entail the idea of miracles. So we'll argue for the possibility of miracles. We'll give a response to the problem of evil. The problem of evil is usually the biggest argument used by atheists against Christianity. And so we'll have to respond to the problem of evil. We'll talk about the coherence of theism. Atheists will argue that the Christian concept of God is incoherent. Fortunately, this is out of print, Theism versus Atheism, the internet debate, where I debated one of America's leading atheists, Dr. Michael Martin, who at the time was the professor of philosophy at Boston University. He's the author of the case against Christianity and the atheism, the philosophical justification. But he's one of America's leading atheists, and we dialogued over a few month period and were able to put the book into print, the transcript of the debate. But you can still, it's still on Internet Infidels, and it's on the Institute of Biblical Defense, my website, biblicaldefense.org. So you can look into that and see how some of America's leading atheists try to argue their case and argue against Christianity. And he uses arguments that the Christian concept of God is incoherent, and we talk about God being immanent, God being close to us, involved with the world, but also being transcendent and far away. He would say that's incoherent, that's contradictory, that's impossible. And so we'll talk about that, the coherence of theism. We'll refute moral relativism. If most atheists, most thinking atheists, not all atheists are thinking atheists, most thinking atheists will acknowledge that if there is no God, then there are no absolute moral laws. And so if we can refute moral relativism, we are a long way to refuting atheism and providing evidence for the existence of a personal, moral God. Then we'll give some evidence for God's existence, the cumulative case for God that I use. My book, No Other Gods, I have a chapter on the cumulative case for God. It also was pretty much taken from my opening statement with Michael Martin in that debate. I've used it three times in public debates with atheists. Actually, four times, because I used it also at Princeton when I debated Princeton University with Elliot Ratzman. So I used it four times, and I don't know if these atheists just don't understand what I'm saying, or if they understand it but just pretend they don't understand it so they don't have to deal with it. But my cumulative case, I just argued that in there's several different aspects. I can go up to 13. Usually I'll use 6 to 9, depending on the length of the opening statement in a debate. But there's a certain amount of different aspects of human experience that when we look at these obvious aspects of human experience, such as our moral experience, the design in the universe, the fact that almost everybody, atheists and Christians, agree that the universe had a beginning, how do we explain that? The continuing existence of the universe, meaning in life. When we look at these different aspects of human experience, it's more reasonable, in each and every one of these cases, it's more reasonable to believe in the existence of a personal God to explain these than it is to be an atheist and reject the existence of God and say that these things either are just there or there are no moral absolutes. There is no absolute truth. There are no moral absolutes. To me, those things are givens of human experience. They're very obvious. I got Dan Barker to admit in a debate at Bellevue Community College, I asked him, if your worldview, if atheism is true, are rape and incest wrong for all people at all times and all places? And he responded by saying no. So he was honest enough to admit that. And on that basis alone, I would reject atheism. But atheists go way out of their way to invent moral laws. But in the end, even Peter Singer will admit his moral laws are not moral absolutes. But he just likes these moral laws, and he thinks if he can get as many people to agree with him as possible, then he wins the day. So we'll try to present a little evidence for God's existence and then evidence for Jesus' resurrection and deity. Let me just say this. Our response to the secular religions is going to be very, very brief. So if you want to follow up on it, you know, some of my books will help out. You could also go to the website, biblicaldefense.org. I have an advanced course. You could just click on to Firefighters for Christ. I've got a 32-lecture course on advanced apologetics, and you could listen to those lectures where I go more in depth. My course on historical apologetics and philosophical apologetics will get even more depth on dealing with these things. And you might even be able to work out a deal with Stan and Shepherd's Bible College to see if you could take a course in apologetics or historical apologetics or philosophical apologetics. Take a course through listening to the cassettes, taking notes, and then he could arrange some papers for you to write and things of that sort. So that might be something you want to look at. If you look at the third page or so, I have this chart, and I don't want us to lose sight of the historical setting for this. You have, and I'll write a portion of this on the board. I'm not going to have the time to write everything up there. But Western civilization became dominated by the Christian worldview. I don't mean dominated in a bad way. It became the dominant view of the leaders and the thinkers of Western civilization. So you had Christianity, Christian theism, okay? But then many of the leaders, even at the while our country was being founded, many of our leaders were becoming deists, though they were pro-Christian deists, and held to traditional moral values. And so the leadership of our country went from Christianity, a God who matters, to deism, a God who doesn't intervene, an irrelevant God, okay? And then eventually that led to atheism dominating the media, dominating our schools and universities, and the belief that there is no God. And once atheists began to wrestle with it, atheism broke down into two different camps. The optimistic atheists, they said, there's no God, you know, hooray, now we can save this planet. But the more realistic, pessimistic atheist who said there's no God, therefore there's no meaning to life, there's no truth, there's no morality, and human life is worthless. There's no reason to even go on in existence. That's basically, this is nihilism, optimistic atheism, several forms, Marxism, Marxist communism, secular humanism, modernism, which is kind of what secular humanism grows out of. But this optimism, optimism has led to somewhat of a pessimistic postmodern view, where the optimistic atheists thought that they could find all our answers, solve all our problems, ultra-rationalistic thought. Well, postmodernism said, no, we can't find truth, we failed, unaided human reason, separated from God, there is no hope, there's no meaning in life, there's no way to find truth. And so you have communities just gathering around stories. Well, pessimistic atheism, they couldn't stay there. I mean, it's like Albert Camus said, the big question for atheists to answer is, why not suicide? And so eventually that led to an existential leap to try to create hope where there is no hope. Existentialism. And even that led to the LSD trips through Dr. Timothy Leary, a psychology professor at Harvard. In the 1960s, he said, well, it's easier to take our existential leaps, to induce them through hallucinogenic drugs, than it is to just take it through an act of the will. And right around that time, the 1960s, Americans are experimenting with LSD and acid trips and existentialism, right at that time, the Maharishis and the gurus came from India. And so this view for Western, the movers and the shakers of Western civilization, has led to the New Age movement and New Age pantheism, believe God is the universe and man is part of the universe, so man is God, things of that sort. It's my belief, postmodernism, something has to give. They already reject absolute truth, they reject absolute morality. They're just into stories, so there's an emphasis, a strain in postmodern thought to bring back the ancient myths. And so I put like a dotted line, you know, a question mark. You don't know for sure, but it's my view that postmodernism will also lead to New Age type thought. And by the way, you can still be an atheist. They have so much in common with many New Agers. You can still be an atheist or a deist. And if you're politically correct enough, and if you really think one world government is the answer, you can still end up joining, locking arms with these people here. So there's going to be a lot of people, and there are right now, who work side by side with New Age pantheists, and behind closed doors will say, yeah, that Shirley MacLaine is a nut. She's a nutcase. Yet, once they see her face to face, they're working on the same agenda with her. And so we're finding leaders and thinkers and movers and shakers throughout Western civilization that are moving somewhere in this direction. And right now, even Marxists today tend to be more postmodern in their thought than anything else. But whatever the case, everything seems to be going to the New Age movement, which is the exact opposite of Christianity. Christianity, salvation only through Jesus. The New Age movement, man is God. Everybody saved. All religions lead to God. So if you want more on that historical perspective, I recommend James Sire's book, The Universe Next Door. He handles worldviews from a historical as well as an ideological perspective. And then I gave about 24 lectures at the Imago Dei Institute in the Seattle area. I believe it was in Redmond. And you can download those from the biblicaldefense.org and then click on Firefighters for Christ and look for the 20 to 24 lectures on worldviews, where I deal with those kind of how in history theism kind of overwhelmed Christian thought as far as the leadership was concerned, and eventually that led to atheism. But atheism is so weak, something has to give, and eventually I think atheism is going to collapse into more of a New Age type thought. Francis Schaeffer spoke about that in the 60s, that if Christians didn't emphasize being good stewards of what God has entrusted to us, And if Christians didn't emphasize us taking care of the environment within a solid biblical worldview, that the he argued the New Agers, Eastern thinkers, would capitalize on that, and Christianity would be considered irrelevant at best and actually harmful to the environment at worst. And exactly what he said has occurred. We didn't put enough time into emphasizing, because atheism won't admit this, but atheism, if left to itself, at least the idea, just live for today and trash the earth. I mean, if you leave a lousy world for your great-grandson, who cares? You don't exist. You're not going to exist to say, wow, I'm sorry that I left such a lousy world for my great-grandson. I mean, you're not even there anymore. You don't exist. And eventually your great-grandson won't exist. No one will exist. So atheism leads to the idea of trashing the earth. In fact, I would say that wealthy Christian businessmen who, and by the way, I don't think there's as many of them that are as guilty of it as our liberal media would have us to believe. But those wealthy Christian business owners whose businesses have led to pollution and things of that sort, that's because they were influenced by secular humanistic thought. It's not because of their Christianity. Christians can be very inconsistent in our thought. But the choice is atheism, trash the earth, New Age pantheism, worship the earth, and Christianity, God gave us the earth as a gift to us. Man's been given dominion over the earth, but we need to be faithful stewards of the gifts that God has given to us. Now, I would argue worshiping the earth will probably trash the earth quicker than trashing the earth would do. For just one example, forest fires. We never had these mega forest fires wiping out thousands upon thousands of acres of land because the lumber industry was allowed to cut, and they didn't want to cut down all the trees and destroy their industry, so they would cut it in different patches and then replant the trees. And so you always had these spaces. So when fires would spread, they would eventually reach a place where there's no more wood, no more trees, and the fires would die out. Now, thanks to our New Age environmentalists, we don't have that many patches where there are no trees, so these fires just spread, and they continue to spread until eventually they hit residential areas. That's why in order to stop them, we have to go against the New Agers' wishes and do a controlled burn and burn down, try to figure out with the way the wind's blowing, with the way the fire's moving, where is it going to go next? Can we burn down enough trees in a controlled burn that doesn't spread, so that when the trees come to that, when the forest fire comes to that point, it will stop. Let's skip the page on creation versus evolution. We'll get right back to it. So I do want to make a few comments on evolution, but go to the page that says atheism/naturalism. Okay, because naturalism is just another name for consistent atheism. It's also called physicalism, and it's the view that only natural things exist, okay? Only nature exists. There is no God over nature. There are no spiritual things. So matter alone exists. So naturalism, materialism, physicalism are three different ways to say this, that the normal, consistent atheist, somewhat consistent, there's no such thing as a totally consistent atheist, but the atheist worldview. Matter alone exists. There's no God, no absolute truths, and no absolute moral laws. Now, atheists don't like that. They don't like, they're pretty happy about not having absolute moral laws, but they don't like the idea of no absolute truths. So it is interesting when an atheist debates me, one of the points I try to make during the debate is the fact that if atheism is true, then there's no absolute truths, so atheism can't be true. Just to take the debate is pretty much conceding defeat if they were consistent.
Yeah, I just have a comment. I've had an ongoing dialogue with an atheist fellow, and he keeps coming up with this new stuff, and I have to go some reading, catch up on it.
Yeah.
But one time he turned to me and he goes, you know that man created God? God didn't create man. You know, I've never been able to find an argument about that. I was just so, yeah. So hence, you know, you can have moral laws and whatever, and maybe some absolutes if you know, but to me, why would man create God?
In the end, they're not real moral absolutes. They always have to try to get a substitute. When you remove furniture from God's universe that is essential to the God's universe, you're always going to have to try to come up with a counterfeit replacement. And so they need to, you know, they say there's no absolute moral laws, and they protest when Christians want the Bible taught in the public schools. Mm-hmm. So they're acting like there's no such thing as right and wrong, but it's wrong when Christians voice their views in the public arena. So, I mean, they can't live consistently with it. But the idea that, you know, man created God, that goes back to Sigmund Freud and before him, Ludwig Feuerbach. R.C. Sproul wrote a book, If God Exists, Then Why Are There Atheists? It used to be called The Psychology of Atheism, where the whole book is devoted to shooting that down. And it's not even an argument against God's existence. And your friend needs to know that. Most atheists aren't even aware of that. Freud and Feuerbach were not arguing against God's existence. They started out by assuming that in a very arrogant fashion, that they are the brilliant thinkers, they and their atheist colleagues, therefore they already know that God doesn't exist. They already, just before even looking at the evidence, they said, you believe God exists, you're a moron. You believe God exists, you're a moron. We're the intellectuals. We know that God doesn't exist. We're beyond all these superstitions. Now, Why do 95% of the people on the planet Earth disagree with us? And so Feuerbach came up with the idea that through wishful thinking, man created God to make him feel, by his imagination, to make him feel a little bit more comfortable about the scary things of nature. And Sigmund Freud went a step further and said, yeah, and because they created that by their imagination, they're either neurotic or psychotic. So basically 95% of the people on the planet Earth are crazy because they disagree with Sigmund Freud and his colleagues. And so it's a very arrogant attempt to explain why these intellectuals are right and the vast majority of the people on the planet Earth are wrong for disagreeing with them. But R.C. Sproul points out no man would invent the God of the demanding God of the Bible, who condemns us because of our sinfulness and tells us, I'll save you, but you don't deserve it, and then makes all these moral demands on our lives. We're going to invent a God. And by the way, the first guy who came up with this view about man's ability to create gods by his imagination, it wasn't Sigmund Freud, and it wasn't Ludwig Feuerbach, it was a prophet named Isaiah. A Jewish prophet named Isaiah. And as you read his book, you find that he talks about these gods, you know, these wooden idols that aren't real. They're just products, gods who came lately, he calls them, and they're products of man's imagination, and he mocks them. God is speaking through Isaiah, mocking them, saying, let's see you guys predict the future. I've known the beginning from the end. I told things that would come about that have come to pass. Let's see you do that. It's a very good explanation, Feuerbach and Freud, very good explanation for false gods, but it's not a good explanation for the true God. The true God of the Bible, no one would... In fact, Paul Vitz has turned the table on Sigmund Freud. Paul Vitz, I think it's at NYU that he teaches, either Columbia or NYU, and he teaches Freudian psychology, but he's Roman Catholic, and in his view, from studying Freud, Freud said that we invented God because we wanted to deify the father image. We were afraid of nature, so we wanted to personify nature, personalize nature so we can beg it to stop killing us with these earthquakes and these storms. And then the first band of humans, Freud came up with a myth where the first band of humans wanted to have sex. I deal with that, by the way, in my The God Who Sits Enthroned, one of the chapters on, I think it's Man's Thirst for God. But the first band of humans wanted to have sex with their mothers because their father was a polygamist, and so they killed their father, and then they felt guilty about it, so they chopped him up and they had a ritualistic meal or whatever, and then they felt guilty about it. So he's trying to explain away guilt. But, you know, he doesn't really explain away guilt. He still pushes it back. If these guys really did, we believe your unbelievable myth, and these guys really did kill their father because they wanted to have sex with their mother, you know, he believed, you know, when a baby is at its drinking milk from his mother's breast, Freud sees that sexually. And so Freud really thinks guys grow up in the early ages wanting to have sex with their mother, and it's like, dude, what are you talking about, man? If somebody's neurotic here, it's maybe it's not the 95%. Maybe it's Sigmund Freud and his buddies. But whatever the case, they wanted to kill the father image. And so they kill this guy. Then they felt guilty about it. Well, why would they feel guilty if there's no such thing as right and wrong? So you still haven't explained away guilt. Guilt is the knowledge that we have done wrong. So, and you take God out of the picture, there's no place for guilt. So whatever the case, Witt said, you can't put Christians in one psychological group and say, well, this guy has certain things about him, so he'll probably become a Christian, or he'll definitely become a Christian, and that guy definitely will. Christians come from all walks of life. Some had bad relationships with their fathers. Some never knew their fathers. Some had great relationships with their fathers. Some were wealthy when they got saved. So others were poor when they got saved. There's people from every different nationality. All different types of people become Christians. You can't pin them down to any psychological group. But the militant first-generation atheist, says Paul Witt, R.C. Sproul, and other Christian thinkers, the first-generation atheist, without fail, had either hated their fathers, admitted to hating their fathers, or had an absentee father, a father that they really had no relationship with. So Paul Witt said, using Freudian language and Freudian psychology, it's not that Christians invent the father image. It's Sigmund Freud and his atheist desire to kill the father image. See, that the ultimate authority is God. And the first authority that we meet in life is our dad, our father. So if you have a really messed up relationship with your father, you're more likely to. It's not that you're going to necessarily become an atheist, but you're more likely to become an atheist and hate all authority, especially the ultimate authority. And so it's a desire to kill the father image and be autonomous. That's why I say the whole essence of human free will is our thirst for God, which God put within our hearts, but also our desire for human autonomy, our desire to be our own king, to be our own boss. And that's what the essence of free will is. And many of us go through our lives and we favor human autonomy. We want to kill the father image. But some of us say, no, my thirst for God is stronger than my desire for human autonomy. Rather than rebelling against God, I'm going to trust in him for salvation. But whatever the case, many of the supposed arguments for God's existence today are, that's a propaganda thing, because in reality they were not intended to be arguments against God's existence. They were last resort attempts by atheists to explain why atheism is so rare in the world. It was basically an attempt to say, well, why 95% of the people on planet Earth at that time disagreed with them. Now, since they've taken over the schools, the percentage of atheists has gone up, but it's still not real, real high. And atheists who are Buddhists don't have anything to do with secular atheists. But whatever the case, with naturalism, matter alone exists. There's no God, no absolute truths, no absolute moral laws. The universe is a uniformity of cause and effect in a closed system. In other words, no miracles, only natural causes. In fact, I would argue that one of the big mistakes of modern science is that we began, because of deism, we began to define science as the search for natural causes, period, so that you will never accept a supernatural cause. And that is So basically, that is not science disproving God. That is science acting as if God doesn't exist, and then saying, look, there are no supernatural causes. But they won't accept supernatural causes. They reject miracles at the outset. Let me just give a little background on deism, which kind of the halfway house between Christianity and atheism. You have a transcendent God, a God far removed from us, who creates the universe but then leaves it alone. So God is not immanent. He's not close. He's not involved with his creation. He doesn't perform miracles. Human beings are not fallen in this system. Man is basically good. And the universe is viewed as a giant clock or a machine. The laws of nature, like the laws of gravity, are viewed as prescriptive, not descriptive. They don't describe the way things are. They prescribe the way things have to be. And so they rule out the possibility of miracles. So deism is a halfway house between Christianity and atheism. There's no practical difference between an irrelevant God and no God at all. So the easy move to make was, if your God's that irrelevant, why not just give up belief in him? Now, the problems with deism, they believe in an unfallen world, yet they have a big emphasis on ethics and trying to make the world a better place to live. Well, if the world's unfallen, why do we even need to move in that direction? Rationalism and induction trying to start with the world of the senses and draw conclusions, trying to draw universal conclusions from data, you know, particular pieces of data, it failed to produce certainty, and it led to skepticism and eventually to postmodernism, where we just gave up and said, yeah, man can't find truth. Human significance, human life being important and worth living, and mechanical determinism are mutually exclusive. So if the laws of nature are the only things that determine what's going to come about, then, you know, human beings are just being forced along. We're really not free. We're really not significant. Human life really isn't important. Now, scientists today no longer view the universe as a giant clock. They see that the laws of nature are descriptive of the way things normally occur, but they're not prescriptive. They don't prescribe the way things have to be. So it's basically, rather than a closed system, scientists today are more willing to accept an open universe where things aren't always the way we expect them to be. This is due to quantum physics and things on that level. It's given scientists less confidence that we've got it all figured out. Okay? So it opens the door for miracles. Now, the biggest problem with deism, if God created the universe and the laws of nature, then miracles are at least theoretically possible. He can intervene and supersede the laws of nature if he chooses to do so. So God is not constrained by the laws that he set up. Now, the irrelevant God of deism led to the view that there is no God, atheism, among leaders in Western civilization. And so that's atheism, naturalism that we're talking about. So the naturalist says matter alone exists, there's no God, no absolute truths, no moral laws, no miracles, only natural causes. And so human beings get reduced to being complex machines, mere molecules in motion. Basically, atheistic materialism really has no sufficient reason to call kicking an innocent human being evil. Because kicking a human being is no different, really, than kicking a mound of dirt. They're both just mere molecules in motion. This is what Cornelius Van Til meant by saying that everyone who rejects the Christian worldview has to live on borrowed capital from the Christian worldview. Because the atheist bank account is empty, is bankrupt, so they have to borrow some capital from the Christian bank account just to explain the normal aspects of life. And this is an example where if you were to kick an atheist dog or an atheist child, they would not treat you the same way that they would treat you if you kicked a mound of dirt. So they act like there is some kind of value, more value to human life and even more value to animal life than just a mound of dirt, non-living material. But the question comes up, why? And that's one of the biggest problems. Scientists are so busy answering the what and how questions, but you can't totally remove yourself from asking the why questions. Why is there a universe rather than no universe at all? I don't think we can totally detach the philosophical why questions from the scientific how and what questions. With atheism, consistent atheism, death is extinction, no life after death. Every once in a while you get a weird atheist who believes in life after death, but you know, I think they're, when they get that inconsistent, you just let them talk and they keep refuting themselves. So death is extinction, no life after death. History is without purpose. Let me read you a quote from Bertrand Russell. I quote from him. He writes his book, a collected essays called Why I'm Not a Christian. And Bertrand Russell talks about how life is absurd if there is no God. And so I'm reading from page 82 of my No Other Gods, A Defense of Biblical Christianity. Bertrand Russell says this, that man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving, that his origin is growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms, that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave, that all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast depth of the solar system, and that the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. Now, immediately following that statement, Russell encouraged his friends to build their atheistic philosophy on this firm foundation of unyielding despair. You could refute that with one question. You could just say, why? If everything I've ever done, everything I've ever accomplished is going to die when the universe dies, if nothing is going to be lasting, eventually the whole universe is going to die, and it makes no difference whether you live your life like Mother Teresa and you helped innocent suffering people, or you live your life like Adolf Hitler and slaughtered innocent people, if it makes absolutely no difference whatsoever, then why do anything? That's why Albert Camus, the French existentialist atheist, asked the question, why not suicide? And he said that's the only question that philosophy should have to answer. Because so basically, his existentialism was having a hard time escaping from nihilism, the idea that there's just no meaning, no worth to life, since there is no God. And then atheistic ethics, they're not based in God. They try to anchor them somewhere else, and they usually fail to do a good job at that.
About when was that Bertrand Russell quote? What was his era?
He died. Bertrand Russell died in 1970, and he was about, I think he was about 98 years old. So, he was with the logical positivists who thought that truth could only be found through the five senses, unless it was true by definition. The problem is that verification principle itself could not be proven through the five senses, and it certainly wasn't true by definition. And that reigned in the first half of the 20th century.
Right,
even
so like the 20s and 30s, he was writing
along. He was writing along in the 20s and 30s. It was already a big name, but he was a big name till the day he died in 1970. So he was probably the most famous philosopher of the 20th century. Mathematician and philosopher. Anthony Flew has probably been the big guy. Now that Russell died, it's interesting that he went from a modern form of atheism to a belief in some type of deistic God just recently. He's been debating Gary Habermas, William Lane Craig, and a few other members of the Evangelical Philosophical Society, and now he believes some kind of God exists, though he's not a Christian yet, Anthony Flew. Now, in the 1940s, He debated Frederick Copleston, the Jesuit priest, who wrote the 9-volume set of History of Philosophy. And I believe it's still in print in a few places. I don't remember the names of the books that contain it, but John Hick, something he edited, he put it in there, I believe. But whatever the case, the debate between Frederick Copleston and Bertrand Russell on does God exist. By the way, my debate with Michael Martin now has been translated into 2 other languages besides English, French and Spanish. So, and I don't know, maybe I should check with Internet Infidels how many, if they know how many people have actually looked into it, but it's made a lot of headway in the world of the Internet. Now, the way you refute atheism and naturalism, those are the things that we talked about. We already talked about how we're going to refute that later on when we get to that point. What I want to do, though, is just spend a few minutes talking about the creation-evolution issue, because evolution often is the driving force behind atheism. And so I just want to talk about some problems with evolution, 6 problems with evolution. The 6th problem are the many unproven assumptions of evolution. Okay? But let's look first at the problems with evolution. First problem that should just jump off the page is the fact that modern science was founded by Bible-believing Christians. You know, if atheism is where it's at, and if that's where really what sets thinking aflame, why? Why Bible-believing Christians? And it was because Bible-believing Christians understood that a reasonable God, a rational God, created human beings in His image, so we're thinking beings, we can reason, and He created the universe in a way that makes sense, so that through reason we could really find out truth about the universe in which we live.